everyone. It's Billy Chamish for my Tuesday show, 6 to 8 Eastern Time. Now, it's a complicated show and unpredictable, but I didn't finish my conversation with Tom Mack last week, and I wanted to. There were three subjects missing, and I should have got to them. There wasn't time. Now, look, the last subject we're going to talk about is very offbeat, and that is putting the Torah to music using biblical signs and signals. They didn't really know tape music back then. And, well, all I can say is I got a musician on from 7 on is David Perkins. He was in Israel for 20 years, and he knows a little something about the Torah, and he knows lots about music. And we're going to put him on afterwards. But I want to say something, an amazing coincidence, because this was not planned when I phoned him. He dropped by with his girlfriend. Well, that was 12 hours driving. He popped in yesterday, and we had a day together. So this has been really quite an eventful show in its own way. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Did you follow all that?
Yes, I did.
All right, I spoke to him in person, no less, and I really don't know music theory, and we're not going to do that to the end, or David will be drowned out by other subjects. There are two subjects I want to do before we get to that. And now the first one, well, what can you say? You're an adventurer. For people who didn't listen to the show last week, David is an author, a computer expert, musician, and adventurer, summarizing it. Now, you're working right now on a subject. Well, it's a stone ruin in Oklahoma. Can you go on about that?
Yeah. Probably one of the most curious things I've ever come across, just personally, was the Hevner Runestone. I was first told about it by a deputy sheriff who was working in Texas at the time, and he had heard about it, gone up and explored it himself, sent me a whole bunch of pictures, and I looked at it, and at first, well, what it is, it's a big 12 foot high, 10 foot wide, 16 inch thick stone. I mean, it's about 2 tons worth of Savannah sandstone with a hardness of approximately 7, according to the Oklahoma State geologist who evaluated it first. When
approximately 7 what?
Okay, on the Mohs hardness scale.
Oh, well, yes, on the Mohs hardness scale, it's a 7, which doesn't mean a lot, probably, to anybody.
Okay. Basically stated, you're not going to go get your steel chisel and pop a hole in it. You're going to have a diamond point chisel, because there are just not too many things that are going to cut this kind of stone.
Yeah. Why would someone... What's it cut in the shape of?
Actually, it is in the shape of what people first thought were Indian markings. Well, somebody wrote the Smithsonian Institute. The Smithsonian Institute responded. A guy named Carl Kimmerer wrote the Smithsonian Institute. The Institute said it looked like Nordic rune letters. And they just said, well, we aren't sure, but that's what we are. But they took little interest in it because the guy that ran it was named Arlis Herdlicka, the Czech name. And he did not believe there were any white men in North America prior to Columbus.
Well, how do you know it's older than Columbus?
Okay, we'll get to that. But, so basically...
And one other point. Sandstone isn't a hard stone. Why not just use a chisel?
Well, as I said, this is a very hard sandstone. That's why it's a 7 and say not a 4 or a 5, which most sandstone is. This is Savannah's sandstone. It's a little bit different proposition. And, but as I said, what happened? The Smithsonian thought it was a fake and dismissed it. But there was a woman, her name is Gloria Farley. She just did not accept that. She was a school teacher, she was educated, and she could tell when somebody was putting her off. So she started writing every runologist, that's what they call these people that study these things.
What else?
Of studying what are called Nordic runes. And so basically when they looked at it, one of them said that it had to date to at least the 11th century. Well, that flies in the face of all historical research, because prior to that, nobody thought the Vikings ever got any further than New England. And if you look at the Kensington runestone, which is very famous up in Minnesota, it dates to the 14th century. And of course, that's where we get the Minnesota Vikings football team. It's from that Kensington runestone.
All right. The Vikings were excellent football players, I take it.
Not this year.
So, the Vikings had an off year.
Well, they've been having a few of them lately, but that's for another time.
Right.
In any case, the presence of a runestone in Oklahoma in the 11th century, according to these people, flew in the face of all of historical teaching, flew in the face of Mr. Hartlicka. He was not a doctor. In fact, one of the things I would say about him is if they were to have an opening of curator at the Smithsonian Museum today, they would not even consider his application because he didn't have a PhD.
Well, it could be a fraud.
Okay, that's something I looked at very carefully, because that's the first thing I thought. This thing's got to be a fraud. But then I started checking the historical evidence, and the Choctaw Nation, when they first came to Oklahoma in 1832, they sent out some hunting parties to look around at the new land they had just been given by the U.S. government. And they saw this little ravine on Heaver Mountain. They thought, nice place for hunting. We can hide in here and get lots of game. Well, we got in there, found no game. And they found this runestone. They found these letters. And they go, you know, hunting party goes, huh? They don't know what they mean. Or at least the people in the hunting party. They consult their medicine men. They come in there, take a look at it. And suddenly, the Choctaw tribe won't settle the area. They won't get near the area.
Why not?
And they won't tell a white man right now.
You're telling me they know how to read Scandinavian letters?
That's why I'm saying somebody knew, because... But I'm now starting to wonder, because I've dug into other research by a couple British gentlemen named Wilson and Blackett, who have also studied ancient languages. And they have a different theory, which we'll get into in a little bit. I want to give a historical perspective before we go talking about the various arguments for it. But as I said, Gloria Farley did an incredible amount of research on this. She studied it, and it became her life's work.
One little stone?
And, well, it's not a little stone. It's a pretty big stone, you know.
Once you've read it once. What other research, what was she researching?
Well, she was trying to find out what the inscription on that stone meant.
Well, you go to a university in Stockholm or Oslo, and you go to the ancient Scandinavian graphology department, and you get someone to translate it.
Okay. Well, back in 1923, that wasn't as easy a proposition as it is today. Because that's when she started doing this. And even into the 50s, it was still a rather difficult proposition. But she did the next best thing. she wrote down the inscription, and she wrote the runologist asked them to translate it for her. Well, they came back. Six of the eight letters fit what is called the Elder Futhark language. But there was two they weren't too sure about because they'd never seen them together on a stone with the other six. And so it sort of laid there until a couple, as I said, this started hitting all the academic circles in Scandinavia, because to them, suddenly they have evidence that the Vikings got a lot further into the United States than anyone at first thought. And even then, back in those days, they were considered out in left field by the normal American.
So this was a search party who took on a very long voyage.
Well, what had happened, the Choctaws came to Oklahoma because they were forced out. They lived in central Mississippi, did very, very nicely for themselves. They had an incredible culture, and they had farming down to a T. But, as you might guess, white man decided he wanted that territory too. And so they went to Washington and pushed President Andrew Jackson and others to pass what they called the Indian Relocation Act, which effectively took the five civilized tribes and told them, you got to pack up everything and move to Oklahoma. And every one of these five civilized tribes has what they call a Trail of Tears. It's basically they had to pick up everything and walk. There was no riding on wagons. Government didn't provide them with provisions. And a lot of people died on these things. This is probably one of the worst pages of American history.
Well, at least they weren't the Nazis. They didn't just put them against the wall and get rid of them.
Well, there was a lot of people in the South who wanted to do that. And four of the five tribes did fight wars trying to protect their territory. The Choctaws left willingly. The Chickasaws fought bitterly. The Seminole Indians fought bitterly. So did the Cherokees and the Creeks. But in the end, they all signed treaties, and they were all given
right,
land
now, look,
in Oklahoma.
This moonstone is on Choctaw land. Where is that?
Okay, it's right on the Oklahoma-Arkansas border, probably maybe 10, 15 miles inside of Oklahoma. There's a state park there. Well, it's actually a city park now. It was a state park for many years, but then the state of Oklahoma had budget cuts.
I would guess there's a reservation, a Choctaw reservation there, where the runestone is on.
Right. Well, it's what happened. It was an Indian reservation until the Civil War, and the Choctaws made one mistake. They sided with the Confederacy. And one of the problems with losing that war is they lost their nation pretty much. And it stayed pretty much a lost nation until about 30 years ago when they won a court case which allowed them, for one thing, to put up gambling casinos all over their land.
Oh, lucky Choctaws.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's one casino, and I've actually been in it a couple of times. And they have some of the best country acts that you can find.
Yeah, it's still not. All right, fine. They found a way to make money. They found a loophole in the law, and they can gamble. And no one will bust them, so they have a casino. But let's get down to the rune. Now,
okay, what happens with the runestone? The Choctaws were deathly afraid of the area. They would not settle there. They would not go there, not for any reason. But what they did do is they let greedy white men buy a permit so they could first trap in the land and then later farm. So where the Indians feared to tread, white man went. and in 1876.
But you said there was no game there, that the Choctaw tried it, and they couldn't trap game in the land.
Well, but they didn't tell the white man that. They just wanted the money, because at the time they didn't have any casinos in the late 19th century, so any money they could...
Exploitative Choctaw Indians sold this crappy land to the white man. What happened to the runestone?
Well, the runestone's still there. As I said, the trappers came in, they discovered it. They called it Indian Rock, because they just figured the Indians did it and didn't investigate it at all. It was just curious to them. And so a lot of stories circulated in the area until a man by the name of Carl Kemmerer actually decided we got to do a little more research, because it didn't. He was smart enough to know that he'd never seen any Indian write like that. That's when he wrote the Smithsonian, which was sort of the premier research institute in the country at that time. I'm surprised he didn't write the University of Oklahoma first, but...
Well, let's keep on. Somebody, first of all, how many letters are on this thing?
Eight.
No, I mean in total, not...
There are eight runic symbols on the...
So they're not phonetic.
Well, and that's just it. They're really not. And the other thing is, and this is where it gets a little interesting. As I said, at first they thought they were Nordic runes. And that's what Gloria Farley practically staked her entire career on, that these were Nordic runes.
Well, I think you should explain what a rune, R-U-N-E, is.
Okay, a rune is a symbol that usually represents something else. What they represent, I can get you 100 runologists and you'll get 100 answers.
Are they only Scandinavian?
And these particular runes are only found in Scandinavia, but they're also found in Ireland, England, where the Vikings raided, and into North America. But with the Hevner runestone, it shocked everyone because nobody thought they'd gotten that far.
Well, again, a search party went looking for new territories and they made it that far.
Yeah. And as I said...
Well, that's as good an explanation as... I can't think of another one. They went looking for new lands.
Well, the thing with the Vikings, though, you have to study their history. They were raiding parties. They raided wherever they went, and they survived by what they stole. They were not farmers. You don't find much of a farming instinct within them at that period in time. Later on, they sort of settled down in Scandinavia and went on to doing what everyone else did.
Well, they tried to farm Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. There was nothing to raid.
And you know, at first we thought that's all the further they really got. They called it Vineland, or Land of Vines. And here in the United States, they considered that to be mythology, that there was no way they could get across the Atlantic Ocean, especially the North Atlantic. But we've now found enough evidence to pretty much disprove that,
And that's been proven for a long time. The fact that there were Vikings in the Northeast is known. But again, you've got this runestone. And by the way, I offered an explanation. They didn't go raiding, they went exploring. But what was written on the stone? What do the six of these eight symbols mean? Or do you have all eight?
One person suggested it meant Gloam's Valley, as if an individual had actually claimed this land. But then there's a lot of them that they debate whether that L maybe should have been an N. That brings up a whole new world of possibilities. As in Gnome Valley, And then we had these little gnomes hanging around. Well, to me that didn't sound very plausible, and it didn't sound plausible to most people who live there either. So another person suggested that it was actually an encoded date, and it happened to be St. Martin's Day, which is November 11th, 1012.
Well, everyone celebrates St. Martin's Day. What's St. Martin's Day?
That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No, not until we know what it is.
Well, it's a Catholic feast day. But as I said, the thing that flies in the face of that is the Vikings did not adopt the Catholic religion until much later. And some of them never did. They adopted Lutheranism instead. And if you go to Sweden, Norway, Finland, and Denmark, they all have state churches, which are Lutheran.
In other words, there's no St. Martin State Parade there.
No.
Right.
So that
one is discounted.
Yeah.
Now we're narrowing down what it actually says.
And so, again, this academic debate went on, and a lot of theories have been put forth. Another one that was put forth was a guy named Dr. Woodward, who lives in Oklahoma. He suggested it was a monument to the explorer LaSalle, and that the French put it there. The only trouble with that theory is the French did not have the technology to move a one-ton stone.
Move from where?
And that's just it. Where did they get it? Where did they move it? And if they just used the stone that was already there, how did they engrave it? Nobody knew about diamond
points. Is there sandstone where that rune exists, or did it come from somewhere else?
Well, and that's another thing that's open to a lot of speculation, is did the thing, was it always there, or did somebody move it? And
look, has a different signature, its own genetic signature. They know where stones come from.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way of determining that. Where is this stone from?
But as far as I can tell from everything I've seen, the Savannah sandstone is all over the Ouachita Mountains, which is the region we're talking about.
So it could have been from around the corner.
Right. They just found a nice one, carved it out, and brought it in. The only trouble with that, like I say, they didn't have the technology to do that. And that's what flies in the face of a lot of this. Nobody had diamond point chisels, even though there is a diamond mine not that far away in Arkansas. In fact, you can go to Crater of Diamonds State Park and not hunt for your fortune in diamonds. Thousands of people do that every year. But even then, mounting it and creating a chisel out of it was not something that could be done.
Oh, wait. We have got our usual three-minute break coming up. Now, in the meantime, tell people how to get a hold of you, and we'll be back after the commercials.
Okay, it's Tom, T-O-M, dot Mack, M-A-C-K, at white, W-H-I-T-E, dash stone, .org. And I'm on the internet right now, so if you want to send me an email, I'm here.
Right. We'll be back in 3 minutes. I'm with Tom Mack. And again, this one is taking longer than I expected, but we're not even close to getting the riddle solved. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Hi, it's Barry Chalmers back for our next segment. Our guest is Tom Mack. For those who don't know, you get my books at lulu.com. at www.lulu.com. You'll see a search box right in my name. Chamish. That's how you spell Chamish. That's how you get to my books. And my website is barrychamish.com. Now, Tom, we've got other subjects, so we're not going to focus on theories that can't possibly be. Have to know, you're writing a book, you're researching this runestone. Let's get specific.
Let me get to my involvement in it now.
Right.
My friend sent me a whole bunch of pictures. He showed me the runestone, showed me the inscriptions. I looked at it, and for everything, I was wrong initially, but it sure looked a lot like Paleo Hebrew. You know, the Hebrew that Moses got. Not the Babylonian Hebrew we use today. And I wasn't sure, but it was sure suspicious enough that in 2006 I made my own trip up there. And I said I was going to get a look at this for myself, because he piqued enough of my interest that I decided it was worth at least looking into. And so I got up there, took a whole bunch of pictures. I've got a half a hard drive full of them. And suddenly I started saying to myself, it's close, but it's not quite. So I started doing my own research, because to me, the rune thing didn't fit. 6 of 8 is not close enough for a mathematician statistically. I've got to have better than 75%, because there's too much room for error. So I finally did my own research, and I came across a couple of British guys named Wilson and Blackett, who had studied ancient languages as well. And as it turned out, they had studied what's called the Welsh Cymric language. And under the Welsh Cymric language, they had a fit. They could tell you what it meant. It meant a good man gone bad.
That's the message?
Yes. But that was not the only rune in the area. Since that time, several other runes have turned up. One of them is as the name Madoc. Well, Madoc is known as the second son of King Arthur. Yes, King Arthur was real. That's something that most people don't realize.
He very well might have been, but he's certainly not been located.
And so, as we started to look a little deeper, sure enough, you could find some kind of artifacts based on the Welsh Cymric language. But the Welsh Cymric language is a descending language from Minoan, from Hebrew, which is why I saw a connection in the first place, and from the Phoenicians, which traveled the world, and the Minoan Empire, which traveled the world before them. We know the Minoans by another phrase. They were the Philistines. They came from Crete. If you look real closely in the history books of the Bible, you will see that the Philistines originally came from Crete. And they literally had a world empire. And when you see Philistine, you come up with what do you come up with? Giant. And I know you've written quite a bit about that, so.
Well, we're known for Goliath. You all know that one.
And he had 4 other brothers, too. That's why David picked up 5 stones. He was ready to take on the entire family. But he didn't have to. They all ran. And that was probably fortunate because...
I don't know that story. The story I know is the Philistines challenged the Hebrews to defeat their fighter, and they expected David to lose, and therefore the Israelites would lose the battle. I don't remember four brothers.
They're chronicled later in the book of 2 Samuel, because eventually the Israelites would encounter Goliath's brothers. And in one case, David's nephew killed him.
Well, he killed a giant. That would be Seth. He killed a giant with six fingers and six toes. That's the last mention of giants in the Bible, by the way.
Right. But it's interesting because now you start asking the question, if these guys, or any of the ancient tribes, because there are literally three ancient worlds that could move a 2-ton stone. The first one is obviously the Egyptians. Look at the pyramids. The second one is the Israelites. Look at the Wailing Wall. Those blocks are 36 tons a pop.
Well, so, all right. There's one that's a butte. It's 600 tons, but that's from 2,000 years ago. That was Herodian.
And so the ability to move those stones, you have to go back a long ways, because in the Dark Ages, nobody moved stones like that. It's almost like the ability was lost for a time. And then the other place, we've got the Egyptians, Israelites, is the Olmecs, which is sort of a forerunner of the Mayan Indians. Because we look at their huge temples, and those stones were not easy to move either. But we don't see any evidence that the Olmecs ever got that far north. They pretty much stayed in Mexico. And so it leaves us with a very, very interesting challenge here. We're looking at a culture that had a considerable amount of technology for ancient times. They could move this stone, and not only could they move it, they could engrave it. All you have to do is go to the Sinai Peninsula and follow where the Hebrews went after they left Egypt, and you'll find inscriptions all over the place. Seemed like they loved to draw, and they did it frequently.
Hold on a sec. We're narrowing down who it is. It's not the Welsh. It's the Welsh prototype language.
Right.
The proto-language, which you are claiming is the known Philistine, and that's who put up the runestone. Am I getting this right?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. As I said, one of the things we've started to learn, because suddenly artifacts are turning up, that ancient Israel was there. Look at the Wealth of Solomon. Some people suggest that he collected a lot of the gold that was in the Black Hills.
Who?
King Solomon. And that he had ships that traveled the world, bringing back the wealth. We know he went to India because peacocks in those times were only found in India. And so they had to be imported. The only way they could be imported is if somebody went to India and got them.
Well, actually, they went to the Arabian Peninsula, and Israel had lots of ties with Yemen and Ethiopia, and peacocks got there. They didn't have to go to India to get peacocks. There were markets.
Could be, because, you know, obviously they found out that the Queen of Sheba was from Yemen. Saw that on the History Channel.
The big question is not the gold from South Dakota. There's a lot of copper missing on the northern shore of Lake Superior that was dug out in a tremendous mining operation a few thousand years ago, and nobody has figured out who took the copper. I think that's if you're looking for proof of somebody with technology that needed copper and they went to Lake Superior, you've got a good case there.
And so I now pretty much concluded it wasn't the Vikings that did all this. but it was tribes more ancient than that. And tribes who still had the technology to do these things. It hadn't been lost yet. So my contention is that runestone, and that's almost a misnomer, but I'm going to use that term because everybody else does. That runestone is probably quite a bit older. And there are a lot of places you can go with that, but the one that seems to make the most sense is what Wilson and Blackett say, that it's a good man gone bad, and from other runestones in the area, it looks like King Arthur's second son, who was sent to North America, apparently, to research all this. This is all in the Welsh records that our beloved British scholars just, they don't want to spend any time with it. They just don't think it's valid. But again, they're the same people that didn't think white men could be in America prior to Columbus. You know, surprisingly, there's still a lot of scholars in this country who don't think white men were in North America prior to Columbus.
Oh, nobody disputes the Vikings.
Well, you would be surprised. I was amazed. I actually ran into a couple of guys who said, there's no way. And I said, well, how can you overlook the evidence? It's all over the place in Maine, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland. You can't overlook it. Columbus was not the first by any stretch of the imagination. But they hang on. And it's
all right, but you're saying now, and this, I don't know how much I would stake my career on it. You're saying that the second son of King Arthur went to Oklahoma and put this runestone on the land?
Well, somebody in his party did. I don't know that it was necessarily him. In fact, I think they were writing about him as a warning.
What was his name? I didn't even know King Arthur had a son.
Well, his first son was King Arthur II. The second son was Madoc. That's the ones we know about. Apparently he had others, but those two were the most important and the ones of note.
And why would Madoc go to Oklahoma?
Well, he was sent to North America to explore it and to look for whatever explorers look for, usually gold, usually some kind of wealth that they can transfer back to the home country. That's what they usually are looking for. And if you remember, the Ouachita Mountains is one of the places in this world where you can find every kind of quartz that exists in the world. And that's, when whenever there's quartz, there's gold. And
is there gold?
And you will find
gold. I've never heard of Oklahoma gold.
You won't, because most of it's too far, too deep into the ground for anyone to feasibly go get. But there's a lot of oil in Oklahoma, too. Or not Oklahoma.
Right.
Well, there's Arkansas and Oklahoma. There's a lot of oil.
Well,
and King Arthur
shouldn't go looking for oil.
But what's most interesting business that's cropped up because of the quartz there is the divining quartz business for the crystals. You can go on just countless websites and buy your own crystal and divine your future, or get yourself well if you're sick. I mean, these people almost are selling it like it's snake oil. It's going to make you well.
Well, again, you're looking for... Look, you lost me. I'm going to tell you this. The rune is certainly... Well, somebody put it there, and I'm willing to accept that it was Minoans or Philistines, because there was mining, and there's a very strong case that a highly technological society mined North America, and not, well, they just dug out vast quantities of dirt for the copper. But again, when you shift to King Arthur and his second son, the story gets less credible.
Okay. The only reason I say that is because, again, one of the stones that they found had his name on it.
Oh, well, you didn't mention that. Oh, you
one
might
of the,
have.
Yeah.
You might have. All right, which stone had his name on it?
They call it the Poto Stone, and it's another rune stone that they found in the area. It isn't quite as big, so I admit there's a bit of a chance that it could have been forged. But what's next, and this is where it's got to go next, is I have been told by some of the Native Americans that there are many, many more rune stones in the area that white man have never seen. And when I get well enough, I'm going to go there, and they have promised they will take me and show them to me. They will let me take pictures of them, but they won't let me excavate them. I don't care. I don't want to excavate them.
All right. Now, this, we're doing what we did last week, actually. I'm going to have to skip the medical. I wanted to talk medicine. I just came from the periodontalist today.
Oh, no.
I've lost $1,200 so far, and it's going to end up $5,000, and these, I've got stories of money-hungry American medicals. Look, it's a disaster, and I want to talk about your accident, and you've lost close to $1 million, I believe.
Yes. In fact, let's take it a step further. When I first went out there, I took a lot of pictures, and I
asked... Wait, we're off the runestone.
Okay. But what happened, weeks later, I had my accident. And believe it or not, some of the Indians will tell me. I don't believe it, but I'm just going to throw it out anyway. They say that I disturbed the spirits around there.
Oh, listen, we only have 7 minutes until we have a long break, and then David Perkins comes on. In that 7 minutes, explain what it means, putting music to the Torah, and then David will speak to you for, let's say, a half an hour.
Okay.
Tell people what it is you do to find, I guess, a duplication of the music that was played in biblical times.
Okay, that's the goal. I don't know that I've reached it yet, and it's still the goal, and it's always going to be the goal to try to duplicate what they have. But in the process, I've tried to make it good sounding to the ears, because some of this stuff I've heard over the years is plink, 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 and it almost drives you insane. So I'll get into more of the technical details in the next half hour, but basically what I've tried to do is using the Torah, and actually it's not both, as my guide. I do not deviate, I do not change the letters in any way, shape, or form, but I've translated the Hebrew letters into musical notes. And once I've translated those notes into, I put them into what's called a MIDI file. From the MIDI file, I create my own music. I admit there's a few presuppositions I've tossed into the mix, and I've tried to be as historical about it as I can. And it's taken me some places I never thought I would ever go. But when you're convalescing from an accident, you have the time to do these things.
Well, very shortly, we're going to talk to a guy who does know the Torah and does know music. And I spoke to him, and again, as I said, I'm no theoretician about music. But he says you've got an interesting approach. Now, how do you know any of it is the music from biblical times?
Again, I'm trying to reach that, and I have to wonder, because you've read about how David played his harp for King Saul, and he got relief. Well, if you read some of the old sages, they argue that he played the Torah. That David played the Torah and rendered
it. What does that mean? They added strings to the Torah and what does that mean?
Basically what he did, he transcribed the letters to notes and he played it. How he did it, the Bible isn't specific about. But when he did it, it helped Saul. Now
there was no Torah in David's time.
Oh, yes,
the Torah wasn't compiled for another 1,000 years.
Well, somebody had it, apparently, because remember, Moses made copies.
Oh, you had the law. You certainly had the five books of... All right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oral history.
That's what I'm talking about, is the first five books.
Right.
And when I talk Torah, I'm talking about the first five books. I guess I better clarify that. But David did that. Also, you will read a couple of times in the book of 1 Samuel where Saul would come into these prophets playing this music. Again, the sages argue that it's the Torah, the first five books. And suddenly Saul is prophesying. He does that twice. Even after he's king, he does it. And it blows everybody away. But then as you study into the Davidic kingdom and Solomon afterwards, music was a very, very important part of that.
Well, there were songs. I mean, the songs were actually poems that were sung.
And I understand that, and that's why I'm saying. And where did they get that? I'm wondering. And, you know, this is just a wonder on my part, is did they get that music initially from the Torah, and then they wrote their own stuff? David did, I would say, probably 100 out of the 150 Psalms. You will notice that Asaph wrote a bunch of them, and there's one that apparently Moses wrote. So,
and they were sung.
Yes, and they were sung.
And you had a band. And you had notes, and you had traceable music in the Psalms. How do you make the songs come alive again?
And
in their original form.
So, again, what I've done, I've come up with an algorithm. We'll talk about that in the next half hour.
Well, you're going to discuss. I'm not going to say very much in the next half hour. I'm going to leave that to David and you.
That's right.
I'm really not qualified to discuss this. That's why I invited him on the show. But in short, do you think any of the music that you have created is, in fact, the music that was played in biblical times?
Again, since I wasn't there, I can't say for sure. But sometimes I get little indicators that suggest to me that I'm getting close, or that I'm at least reaching back to what they did. Can't say that I'm perfect yet. I probably will never get to the point where I can totally recreate it for what it is.
Well, don't forget, Middle Eastern music has all these quarter tones. It's not Western music.
And that's the hardest thing about it all, is I have had to go back and research this thing, and I found out that most everything that we normally think with music doesn't apply back then.
Well, look, they had their dancing girls, and I assume if they were dancing, there was a pretty good bop in the background to dance to. We have plenty of indications that music was a big part of things, but I'm going to say it again. Have you got it in part, 10% even, is this the music that you would hear in biblical times?
I would say I'm getting there.
All right. Tell people we have a 7-minute break now. Quickly, tell people how to listen to music.
Okay. Go to themusicofheaven.com. Themusicofheaven.com. It's all free. I don't charge anything for my music.
All right, people, we have a...